Bradley has set the stage beautifully for us regarding the resurrection story that is told in 1 Corinthians in chapter 15 in verses 35 through 49. Now, that's not going to get us to the end of the chapter. We still have one more. In fact, the last message I'll preach next week from chapter 15, and it is easily my favorite, so I've already looked ahead. I've cheated. And so I know how the story ends, rather than spoiling it, we'll get to it next week. But what is really important is the way it all comes together with a greater understanding of the resurrection. Now, a lot of the information that will give way to the inspiration that we see next week is found in this passage today. People ask questions all the time. What is heaven like? What's it going to be like when Jesus comes? What are we going to do? How are we going to live? What's that going to feel like? All these kinds of questions come up from time to time. And we all wonder about them. It's why one of the things that draws us to studies of last things and why we have such an interest in the second coming is because of the unique nature and the mysterious surroundings that are associated with that subject. And so we're always drawn to that. We want to know more about that. We're intrigued by it. There's nothing wrong with that. It's actually good. It gives us some excitement, enthusiasm, and motivation for study. But there is information available. And we can know some things about what is to come. God has given us a lot of that information in order to make us more faithful. Now, how does that work? Well, when you know something, then you have a confidence about it, and it changes the way you live today. You don't live with uncertainty or fear, but you live with confidence and expectation. You live with hope and anticipation. That's really the crux of what we're dealing with here. We are a part of a world that, for the most part, has lost its hope. And we know it's true. Because even as believers ingrained in the truths and the disciplines of truth, we still struggle at times. Hope is hard sometimes to hang on to. And the pressures of the world and the demands of our experience and the way things work out beyond what we had imagined, usually not for the better. We come to the conclusion, what's the point? I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people that were hurting that have said, you know, I've trusted Jesus. I've tried to live my life according to what the Bible teaches. And yet this has happened or that has happened or I've lost this person or I've lost that thing. What's the point, they'll say. Exactly. You see, there is no point in this life beyond the hope that is inspired for the one to come. Everything that you're experiencing now is a part of the process by which God is working out His grace through you as well as in you in order to accomplish something that is so far beyond you that the Bible tells us our minds cannot even conceive of it. Because of that, people not only disparage of hope, but then they turn to themselves to find solace. If I can't understand it and if I can't explain it, then it isn't real. And so we resort to man-made solutions to eternal issues that aren't going to work because the information is too limited. That was exactly what was taking place in Corinth. There were people that had come into the church or that were at least, at the very least, influencing the church. And they were saying, well, the resurrection's not possible. And even if it were possible, what would that look like? A bunch of deceased people being raised from the dead, walking around like zombies? This is not the walking dead. And trust me, there were a number of possibilities for walking dead references for the title of this sermon. I resisted it. Some of you think it. What is he talking about? And that's good. I'm glad you think that. Stay innocent. and some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. That's not what this is. This is not something where we're going to come back to life the way Lazarus did, or where we're going to be raised in a condition that is consistent more with the decay of the flesh than it is with the glory of the Spirit. But there was this misunderstanding. It had infected the church, and now it was leading them down a path that was creating this disillusion of hope. And not only that, then they had division within the church. So Paul writes to them, and he says, I can help you with this. And he gives us this information that is intended to inspire hope. It's a very simple teaching about the nature of the resurrection body. It's just very direct and straightforward. I like it because it doesn't have a lot of the questions and uncertainties associated with some of the things that we have already dealt with. This is something that is very solid, that is easy for us to grasp. So he says in verse 35, here's the how of the resurrection body. He said, someone will ask, how are the dead raised and what kind of body will they have? So these questions Paul uses rhetorically in order to set the stage. Here's the situation. You wonder what's going on in Corinth. What's the argument about? What's the discussion like? What are the conversations that are leading them down the wrong path? Here it is. Paul just lays it out there in summary fashion and says it all revolves around two questions. How were the dead raised? Because I can't understand how that can happen, therefore it cannot happen. That's what was happening there. People were saying, since I don't understand it and I can't do it, it isn't possible. You need to understand that this is a basic philosophical and spiritual issue that really strikes at the very heart of our existence. And so until you get this one worked out, you're going to always struggle with these kinds of questions. And faith is going to be something that eludes you for the most part from a practical point of view. Now, I've taught you over the years the importance of having a Christ-centered, God-centered worldview. What does that mean? It means that you believe that everything exists because of God, everything remains in existence because of God, and everything ultimately will come to its final fulfillment for the glory of God. Now, can I explain all of that, and can I make sense of everything that exists in the natural world? For the most part, I can. And I have a very strong confidence in the faith that God has given us that enables us to use our minds to understand the truth that He has given us in His Word. And it's very logical. And you say, well, huh, I thought this was just church stuff. A Christian worldview, a God-centered worldview, does away with a church box. There's no more church box. So you don't have boxes in your life where, you know, you put your work, and you put your family, and your relationships, and you put your leisure, and you put your money, and you put your faith. You know, there's no faith box. There's no church box. When you have that, you do not have a Christian worldview. You do not have a God-centered worldview. You have a faith that exists only when you're at church or only when you think in the realm of things that you consider to be church-related. That's a traditional religion. Now, is it wrong? Yes, it is absolutely 100% wrong. Can it lead to something that's right? Happily, yes, it can. But you got to make the jump. You got to move from getting in your church box once a week or once a month or whenever it is you do it, and you got to realize that that box has to be dumped out and allowed to be a part of everything, so that now everything else gets put into that box, and that box encompasses all of life. So that your family and your relationships and your work and your leisure and your plans and your possessions, they all belong to God. And you You came from him, you will return to him, and he controls everything between the two points. That's a Christian worldview. Christian worldview then demands that we see the world in light of the overall purpose of God and glory of God, understanding that everything exists for him and because of him continues in its existence. So when we ask the question, how are the dead raised? The reason we're confused is because we know we can't do it. So therefore, because we can't do it, we assume it can't be done. And that's simply not true. There's lots and lots and lots of things you and I can't do. They get done every single day. So it's a flawed argument. What kind of body will we have? If it were possible that a resurrection could take place, what will the body look like? And this is where this business of the walking dead comes into play. Their minds were that they're going to be raised up out of the ground and they're going to look exactly the way they did while they were in the ground. And he says, that's not so. And it isn't. So what does it mean? Verse 36, he answers the questions. But he first offers an admonishment. He says, you foolish person. You fool. Now, this is a strong word. It's not something that I realize that our language is a little different. We don't use this word in the strength that it was used then. But this is Paul calling them stupid. I don't know. It's not just corrective. It's punitive. He's mad. And he expresses that in a very strong way. And so you really kind of need to get the sense of this. He said, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I can't believe you feel this way. After everything that I've taught you, after everything that you've experienced through your relationship with Christ and the redeeming work that he has wrought in your life, I cannot believe you would listen to this drivel. So then he goes on, he says, but I'll explain it again. What you sow does not come to life unless it dies, and what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare kernel, perhaps of wheat or some other grain. Resurrection, in fact, is transformation. That's what he's talking about. And so Paul explains how resurrection is going to look and how it's going to be and how we're going to experience it and what's going to be involved in it. So notice the second thing then. Resurrection is transformation. Think about it, first of all, from these perspectives. It is foolish to doubt or question the ability of God. Just because we can't imagine it or do it doesn't mean that God cannot. And so he's calling us to shift our dependence away from ourselves and onto him. He is demanding a shift from a man-centered worldview to a God-centered worldview. Think differently, in other words. Think more in terms, not of what you or I can accomplish, but think in terms of what God can accomplish. They said Jesus couldn't rise from the dead either, but he did, and you saw it, and you heard him, and you know it's true. We were singing one of the songs, and the word said, a borrowed tomb. 3 days in a borrowed tomb. You ever wonder why he only borrowed one? He wasn't going to need it again. He didn't need to own one. Why put up the money for a tomb that you're not going to use but 3 days? Rent one. This is a big deal. Jesus borrowed a tomb because he wasn't going to need it very long. It was just long enough for you and I to be persuaded that this is really happening. And then he rose again. He says in verse 36, the seed is buried and dies, but it gives life to a plant. He says, you foolish person, what you sow doesn't come to life unless it dies. So he uses the analogy of a plant in order to help us understand that. He says, what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare kernel. So you put a seed in the ground, the seed decays and it dies, but what comes forth from the ground doesn't look like seeds at all. It looks completely different. it looks like a plant. It's different in stature and nature and every form. It's different, but it came from something else. The same thing is true, he says, of the body. The body will be sown in death. But what will rise again will be something completely different. It will be transformed. Resurrection indeed is transformation. So that the plant that grows is different from the seed that is planted. In verse 38, he says, but God gives it a body as he has chosen into each kind of seed its own body. For not all flesh is the same. So he says to us in verse 38 that ultimately the kind of body, Paul says, I'm not sure exactly what it's going to look like. Are you going to have superpowers? I don't know. Can you fly? I don't know. Will you have x-ray vision? I don't know. Yes, all of that would be super cool. And who wouldn't want that? You know, you can't spend as many hours as I have watching Marvel movies and not imagine that maybe heaven's going to give me some of those abilities. Problem is, it'll give everybody else the same stuff and then it won't be cool anymore. Superman's only cool because there's just one of him. We're all going to be Supermen in heaven. So he's telling us that what's going to come forth is going to be quite unique. But here's what he says. I don't know exactly what that's going to be like. He says it's according to what God has chosen. You ever thought about why corn plants come from corn seeds? And why they look the way they do? And they have ears on them and they, you know, have crowns when they set the stalk and tassels when the ears are set? Tassels are basically the flags that God flies to tell all the coons to come get the corn, right? It's a cycle of life, you know. You ever wonder why that is? I honestly haven't. I can honestly say that I've never stopped to think, gosh, why did it turn out like this? Because not every plant looks like that. They're all different. My neighbor planted plants this year that when he purchased them, the tag said Brussels sprouts. When they came up, they looked for a while like Brussels sprouts, and then they turned into cabbage. Which cabbage is a type of, or Brussels sprouts are a type of cabbage. But they're not the same. Couldn't tell it until the plant was full grown. Same thing here. What he's telling us is that this transformation that takes place is based on God's choosing. God is the one that chooses. God is the one that has decided and determined and will do so moving forward what the body will look like. And so he says in some regard, you can know some information, but it's only enough to give you confidence that what will be coming forth is going to be quite different than what you have imagined. And that is not so different from what you've grown accustomed to in this life. Even in this life, when we plant a seed, what comes forth is quite different. So this is not a unique thing, but rather something that follows the pattern, again, of our understanding of the world around us. The differences in creation then support the concept of resurrection, so that in verse 39 he says, for not all flesh is the same, but there is one kind for humans, another for animals, another for birds, another for fish. There are heavenly bodies, talking about the sun, the moon, the stars. And there are earthly bodies, talking about the stuff that's on the earth. But the glory of the heavenly is of one kind. It exists in space and in the universe. The glory of the earthly is of another. They are quite different. They do not share any of the same properties for the most part. And yet they coexist because of the amazing creative ability of God. So that he says in verse 41, there is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for stars different from star in glory. So again, he's talking about the unique things that we see in the created world around us, that they are also quite different. And this supports the concept of the resurrection and the body being raised, being different or transformed. So what will it be like? How is resurrection possible? By faith in God. In the same way that God brought all things into existence and gave them unique qualities and properties that are distinct and unique from one another and yet exist together in unity and harmony. in the same way that he did that, he will raise us up. And he will give us, on that day of resurrection, a body of his own choosing that will be perfectly consistent with the glory that he has determined. And in that process, you will experience ultimate transformation. Resurrection, then, is transformation. Transformation takes us from the natural to the spiritual. Look at verse 42. He says, "So it is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown is perishable. What is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness and raised in power. It is sown a natural body, but it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body." Transformation is from the natural to the spiritual. Now keep in mind, transformation, I said to you earlier, or implied it, is not reanimation. Resurrection is not reanimation. He's not going to take the body that you have now, in whatever condition it is when it dies, or when he comes back, and that's what you're stuck with. That's not going to happen. He's not going to take the body that is dead in the grave and make it alive again the way he did with Lazarus. Because Lazarus then died again. That's not going to happen. That's not what this is. Resurrection is not the same as resuscitation. Now, I'm not suggesting that Lazarus wasn't fully dead. He was. But nothing changed other than he was alive again. And eventually he died again. Resurrection changes everything. It's a transformative experience that alters every part of you. So it's not just reanimation. But he says the natural comes first. He describes this transformation. Perishable becomes imperishable. What is subject to decay and corruption is no longer subject to decay and corruption. Dishonor becomes glory. The struggles that we all have with sin and the sinful nature, it's all gone. What's it replaced by? It's replaced by the glory of God. Weakness. We have limitations. We have inabilities. That extends everything from the weakness of the body to fight off an infection or a disease that is a part of this broken, fallen world, to the kind of weakness of the mind that sometimes afflicts us to the point that we're unable to do the very things that we know we want to do. He says that's replaced with what? Power. Accomplished, finished, final power. The natural becomes spiritual. We long for the spiritual, don't we? Do you realize that's one of the reasons that we gather for worship? Is to join together, to encourage one another, that we might experience the spiritual presence of God at work in a shared fashion, so that what one is lacking, the other supplies, and vice versa, so that as we come together to celebrate and to worship, we are doing so not only for what God is doing in us, but what He is doing through us for others. Please don't ever think that worship is about you. It is always about us. There is an us to the church that must never be denied or overlooked. And there is no individualism. When we gather for worship, it is a spiritual experience. It's a way for us to interact with that which is going to be the permanent state one day. We start out in the natural world, we finish in the spiritual world. In the meantime, we have this connection, this contact of the indwelling presence of God that affirms these truths as real. Natural becomes spiritual. Look at verse 45 then. When he says that the spiritual will be realized through faith in Christ, he says, "Thus it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being, but the last Adam became a life-giving spirit." Now he says that how all of this comes about, this transformation that he's talked about, this resurrection that he has affirmed, how does all of this take place? It takes place through Jesus Christ. Adam was pronounced by God. As he blew the breath of life into him, it says he became a living being. It means living soul. And so in that sense, he took the dust of the ground and he shaped and fashioned it into the man, and he gave him a living soul and made him alive. What a wonderful and miraculous, amazing reality that is for us. And yet, look at what's going to happen. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. What was limited by flesh is now unlimited by God. Faith in Jesus Christ is the release. It is the divinity that we long for. It is the very heart of God that is in every human spirit and soul. The living being to a life-giving spirit. Verse 46, he says, "But it is not the spiritual that is first, but the natural, then the spiritual." So the natural is first. This is the plan of God. It is the purpose of God. It is the means by which God has chosen to fulfill His covenant arrangement with us in order to bring the ultimate glory to Himself. The spiritual is last. So everything that we are experiencing now in this natural world is moving and propelling us forward. And we'll find its ultimate conclusion in the spiritual realm. In verses 47 and 8, he says, "The first man was from the earth, a man of dust, but the second man is from heaven. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are of the dust. And as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven." Man is of dust, but Christ is from heaven, so that through faith in Jesus Christ, we go from being earthbound to heaven promised. We go from the physical limited to the spiritual unlimited. What we experience now, we experience by faith. We walk by faith, not by sight. But it is absolute certainty and confidence of that which is to come. But it is dependent on what Christ has done. He shows us that in this verse. The first man from the earth, man of dust, but the second from heaven. Jesus came from the Father to us, God incarnate. He lived, He died, He rose again. This is the promise and this is the example. This is why we can have faith and this is why He calls us to faith. We are of this earth, but Christ is from God. Verse 49, "Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven." The image of the man compared to the image of heaven. Today, you and I bear the image of the man of dust. We are more like Adam than we are like Jesus, at least on the outside. On the inside, we bear the image of Christ. This is why Jesus told us to make disciples, to train, to teach, to encourage, to help, to build the church. To do these things, not just to make converts, but to make believers and followers of Christ that are in fact disciples. This is why we do ministry experiences for everybody to practice what they're learning and to utilize the gifts you've been given. This is where we express who our highest identity really is connected to. And this is where we discover that which is to come. So that however long we live on this earth, we do so to the glory of God, realizing that this is a process in which we are learning to become that which Christ died to make us. Bound to this earth, you are limited to its end, which is destruction. Bound to the man of heaven, there is no limit, and you have the hope of eternity. Now, Paul wrote this not intending it necessarily to be evangelistic to lost people, because lost people weren't the ones hearing it. He intended it to be instructional and informational to saved people. He was trying to set right false teaching. He was trying to reestablish the believers in a proper alignment with truth. And so that's really the point of it. But he also knew that when this word was read, and he even made reference to this before when he talked about their gatherings and his concerns about their worship services being decent and orderly so that when people came in that weren't believers, they wouldn't be scared off by weirdness And so he told them to conduct themselves in a way that was sensitive to the needs of those who would be unfamiliar with a Christian worship experience, so that some of them would hear that truth, and upon hearing it, would be convicted of it and brought to salvation. So here's the thing. While he didn't intend it necessarily to be evangelistic, it is so filled with gospel truth that there's no way to prevent that, nor should we. So what I'm saying to you is this. If you're a believer today, this should give you information about your faith that informs it to a level that can enable you to grow beyond traditional religion and grow into a life-affirming daily experience of relationship with God that transforms who you are from the inside out. For however long you were here, until that day you experienced the ultimate transformation when you were with Him, either because He comes to get you or because you go to Him. But if you've come in today and you've never committed your life to Jesus for salvation, maybe even some of these terms are unfamiliar to you, and you've heard people talk about heaven, but in your mind that's just some distant ethereal experience that has more to do with angels and harps than it does with anything else and really doesn't relate to your daily experience. If that's what you have come in here today, and now as you hear this, your heart is kind of stirred and your mind is kind of on fire and you want to know more, I want you to know that that's not me. That's the Holy Spirit working on you. And that's God calling you out of ignorance and out of something that is never going to produce the fulfillment that you long for. And He's calling you into that which can only be described as a relationship with Himself through faith in Jesus. You say, well, I don't understand any of that. That's good and that's fine. All you have to understand is that you need more information. And you need to understand the way to get it is come talk to me.